This is BBC. BBC Radio. Six Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with Ian McCulloch.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to The First Time here on BBC Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. My guest in this episode of The First Time has, since 1978, headed up a hugely important band. They were born of a fertile post-punk Liverpool music scene, and while they shared a certain amount of attitude with the DIY bands that came before them, they had a scale and a cinematic grandeur that was unique in 80s guitar music. They wore their influences proudly, seeing themselves as adding to the lineage of David Bowie, the Velvet Underground and the Doors, and their artistic ambition and personal self-confidence saw them construct a pedestal from which they often looked down on their peers. All of which could be regarded as arrogant if it wasn't for the music and a run of pretty faultless singles and at least one album that could be called a masterpiece, 1984's Ocean Rain. In fact, my guest has no issue with labelling that as one of the greatest albums ever made. My guest on The First Time this week is, from Echo and the Bunnymen, Ian McCulloch. Ian talks about the impact that music had on his childhood and the role that music plays in the lives of nearly everyone in Liverpool, and discovering some of the bands that inspired him then and now, including David Bowie, he saw the Ziggy Stardust tour, and Leonard Cohen. We also hear about the very first Echo and the Bunnymen gig, their early success, and the writing, recording and release of Ocean Rain, and Ian's relationship with Will Sargent, his bandmate and guitarist, whose playing defines the band almost as much as Mac's voice. We also talk about Ian's struggles with shyness, not just in his early days, something that might surprise people who take his bravado at face value. And we discuss the circumstances around the breakup of the band and their reunion in 1998. But I started by asking Ian, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
We never had a record player, which, until I shared one with my brother off the catalogue when I was 13 or 14, we had a cassette, mono cassette thing before that. One of my earliest memories was singing in junior school. I must have been about 6 or 7 in the toilets with, by the wash basins. And I think it was All My Loving for some reason. All my loving. I don't know how I ever heard this stuff, because we didn't have a radio until my mum got one from the market in about 1970, 71. So it must have been on the telly, but even then it wasn't really a house that full of music. My dad used to sing in the pubs, apparently, you know, before he had my brother and sister and stuff. So it was All My Loving, the Beatles. I remember being on a bus going to the Pierhead, I think with the family, and for some reason, I think it was I Want to Hold Your Hand, was someone must have had it on and down, you know, on the bus on the radio. I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. And that sticks in my head. You know, it did sound magical. Not my favourite band by any means, but I always think when we started with the Bunnymen, we have a rehearsal room in a place called The Ministry. And we used to go to a calf called Brian's Calf and walk down Dale Street. And one time we all got winkle pickers. And we were walking down Dale Street to the rehearsal room, and I looked down, we were in a line, I just thought, God, the Beatles did this. You know, and things like that, when I think of the Beatles actually being in Liverpool and walking around, it does make me go, oh, you know, it's amazing. In slightly different winkle pickers. I was aware of Elvis Presley because of the films, and I loved his voice.
What's the Elvis track? You remember? Is there one song? Because, I mean, for a kid, he looked pretty great. I mean,
he was amazing.
Yeah.
Just, it was probably Love Me Tender. It would have been one off one of his films, I would have thought, because, you know, I remember watching a few of them.
Love me tender, love me true, all my dreams fulfill.
and the first bit of music that you owned, it was like, I bought that with my money, this is mine, this is not on the radio, this is not on
Ziggy Stardust.
Oh, so we started there, did we? Went straight in for...
Yeah.
Tell me, okay.
Well, yeah, because we didn't have a record player, so I got that on pre-record cassette from, I think it was Rushworth in Liverpool. Another, like, Beatles connection, because Rushworth's next door, or to Nems, which is where Brian Epstein had his office or something.
His office, his record shop, yeah.
And, Ziggy Stardust, I think it was £2. I could see the sticker now on the... something like £2.14. Something like that.
Tell me about putting that record on.
Well, it was a cassette, sorry.
Well, putting the cassette. Hearing, because it's still one of your favourite records.
Yeah, it changed my life completely.
What track off, Sicky, should we play?
Well, everyone knows about Starman and that being, lots of people saw him on Top of the Pops. It actually got me Starman before I saw Top of the Pops. It was his voice on the radio in the morning, the song and that stage when I was 12. You know, we'd had the moon landing and stuff, and I saw it on Star Trek. All of that, I was really into, not so much science fiction, but the idea that Bowie came from outer space, I suppose. Didn't know what time it was, the lights were low, oh, oh. I leaned back on my radio, oh, oh. Some cat was laying down some rock and roll, and a solo said. Then the loud sound that seemed to fade came back like a slow voice on a wave of fade. That weren't no DJ, that was hazy cosmic time. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow our minds. There's a star.
BBC Radio 6.
Music. First gig you went to?
David Bowie.
There we go.
June the 10th, 1973.
I love the fact you can remember it was June
the 10th. Evening show. He did a matinee, but in those days, it's like I could only afford to go to one. I missed him at the Top Rank in Liverpool in, I think that was around the June of 72, because I didn't know anyone who'd go with me. I asked my brother, I was mad, but I missed the actual. Ziggy had eyebrows and that insane. Didn't. And it meant loads to me. It's like, I don't like him without his eyebrows. Well, it just didn't. I still loved him, but it didn't have the same.
Missed eyebrows.
Yeah. And then he got them back, the eyebrows, after Young Americans.
What can you remember from that show? Because shows like that, like, how they exist in your memory.
I remember going on my own. I was really nervous just about going anywhere on me, Todd, because I was 10, 14 then, but apart from going to school, I don't think I'd been anywhere on me, Todd, you know. There was that. I was meant to go with someone from school. He got into Bowie much later than me, so I was glad he got chicken pox. Kind of a little bit daunted by the whole thing. First time seeing Bowie, for starters.
When was the first time you sang in public? And the first time you realised that I've got a voice, I can do this?
It was the first time I sang and realised that was along to Bowie Records, and when everyone was out the house, the furthest away from the neighbour wall as possible, and probably sang quite loud and hope no one heard me, but it wasn't until probably The Bunnymen.
Really?
Yeah.
There wasn't like little...
I knew I had a voice because of singing along, but you never know until you pick a mic up, and so... There was a rumour that I was. There was this thing. I'm not going to mention it because it gets mentioned, and it's all fabrication. A fictitious group before The Bunnymen.
What? So because there's a couple of myths, yeah. And this is actually basis. There wasn't this.
Well, I think I mumbled something without a microphone to this rubbish that the other two were playing, more sarcastically. It was So with The Bunnymen. Yeah, first time in front of anyone, really, because I never sang along. I was that shy. Even something like a family get-together where people sing along. Even You'll Never Walk Alone, I'd sing that under my breath because I used to go to Max all the time when I was a kid. And it always sounded weird. It's like, hang on, this doesn't sound like singing to Ziggy Stardust anymore. It was at the first rehearsal with The Bunnymen when Les came in, yeah, on a drum machine, and we only had one song, so I think I left it till the gig. I'm sure I just said, I've got something.
Really?
Yeah, because I thought, what if it's rubbish, or what if...
That's a sensible plan.
I think I got through the whole thing, just because I did look like a singer at that point, and it was always maybe sweating cobs underneath, thinking, God, I can't do this until... And then when we were on stage, it was a Wednesday night, and we had one song, the drum machine didn't work, so we had to wait on stage for about 10 minutes. And Will looked up and he went, it's not working, do you two want to, I'll try and sort it out. And I just looked at him and said, I'm not going anywhere. We can't, finally my dream comes true, and then I have to sod off because the drum machine doesn't work. So we stood there for about 10 minutes, and finally it kicked in, and we did the song, and I think that weight on stage helped me just think, it's not my fault if anything else goes wrong, because it started totally unbelievable for the drum machine to not work. This is the moment where I've been waiting for all my Saturday life. And it wasn't really singing so much as I loved the fall, and the first song, Monkeys, I think it was called High Bags of Yours initially, and it was just that, but it was kind of based on the Foley guitar thing. Monotonous as it gets. Came out and I thought, people are looking at us and I think it's working. It wasn't as much singing as just projecting something that wasn't going on at that point in Liverpool. It sounded more serious than it probably was. In Liverpool at the time, I think we were the first band that just went, we've had punk, now we're doing something Big difference, I think.
Is that when that being unsure turned into we're good? Turned into that confidence?
Well, I said to Will, it was the first time I went to his house with an acoustic. He had a drum machine and a homemade guitar that his dad had made, I don't know how. And I went there, I had to take three buses with a guitar, which again wasn't me. It was like, God, I've got a carry guitar and everyone look at me thinking I'm a musician or something. I still to this day find that a bit weird. But anyway, when I left his house that day, I was only there for a few hours because I couldn't stand it. It was like, he didn't talk much, Will, and I was shy. I played three chords and he played this thing. And then I said, we're the best band in the world. To Will, yeah. And he just looked at me like, I just thought, we are. It just, for me, it sounded, even without any vocals on, it just sounded different. And a bit like The Fall, maybe a bit velvety as well. It was only one thing, and it was an acoustic going, cha-chang, and Will going, di-di-di-di-di-di. But it just sounded right, you know. I thought, for some reason, I must have felt, this is forever now, or this was what I've always wanted. And that was before even a lyric had been written. So, because, you know, I'd hung around with mates and stuff who all played, but it never appealed to me any of what was going on. But Will, you know, we just had this thing, I thought, that already sounds like the basis for whatever it was I always wanted to do. You know, so that was a first, going to Melling, just outside of Liverpool. Melling.
Do you remember your first review? Would that have been for?
For Pisses on My Wall.
Can you hear it? The sound of something burning, something changing.
It's a mad track for a first.
It is, yeah. I mean, we've got three singles of the week. Sounds, Melody Making an Enemy, I think. And was it Paul Molly who did the one in the NMA? And he just said, whoever these are, do you know what they're doing or something? I just thought, well, he could have filmed me. Yeah, it was, you know, across the board, kind of, this is something different. I couldn't listen to it now. Again, I'd cringe too much. But I knew at the time, I was obviously saying at the time were the best thing. That one track is better than anyone else's entire whatever output. And, you know, and I'd say things like that because I'm a scouser. We used to go to the football. And I always thought, although I kind of half believed it, or I had to half believe it because otherwise the shy me would stay where he was, and I wouldn't take it any further. So a lot of it was that, and it'll be, I suppose, go on stage, which I now feel is my natural habitat. But I never got stage fright, but I think you're aware of so many different things. How where do I put my feet? You know, what angle do I go? And, you know, it just seemed right. And I think watching The Fall helped, because I thought, if he can do it, and he was so... Marky Smith. First thing I'd seen other than Bowie, I suppose, and egging that from afar, but close up, seeing someone who just had it, you know. Dead funny, Marky Smith band, but he just oozed this intelligence, you know, and cool.
Face on roots. Debtors retreat, escape. Debtors escape, escape.
From the first album, From Crocodiles, that went top 20. How do you get on with that attention? Because straight away, you know, regardless of your opinion, if...
Did it go to number 10 or something? And I thought, why isn't it number one? We kind of took it in our stride. It wasn't... I think we always felt that other people of that kind of era... we're doing better or kind of getting played more or something. I know we were awkward, still are. So.
Were you scarily ambitious?
We were never ambitious in terms of, you know, the
scale.
Perceived, yeah, that success thing. And I thought, nah, if you're getting singles of the week, then that's success. And people would say that goes, you know, you won't be flavoured of the month, year or whatever, forever. But I don't know, we were still trying to follow the course musically of where we were going rather than plot any. It seemed a bit... I just took it for granted that it would grow, I think. It's all of that please like me stuff that we don't do in Liverpool. It's kind of, we take it for granted that we're okay. Yeah, as a people and stuff. And it's hard, I think, to... It was always hard for me to court... being liked that much, you know. I mean, I want to be able to like the music and the band and stuff, but something in me must have had a self-destruct, you know. I'll say things that are really contentious and get on loads of people's work, you know. And that worked.
You're listening to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest this week is Ian McCulloch.
It's BBC Radio
6 Music.
Now on BBC Sounds.
6 Music.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is The First Time on 6 Music, where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is, from Echo and the Bunnymen, Ian McCulloch. And that was the Bunnymen classic, Bring on the Dancing Horses, from 1985, which further helped cement the band's reputation in the US, as it was used in the movie Pretty in Pink, and it also illustrates Mac's poetic turn of lyrical phrase. And where did that come from? When did you first fall in love with Leonard Cohen?
When I was either 14 or 15, it was when I'd seen a clip on the old grey whistle test.
14's young to be getting into Leonard.
Yeah, I was I'd seen a clip on the whistle test of, what was the film called? Old Bird on a Wire, I think. The clip was of him swimming in an empty swimming bath somewhere. And I went to see it, and there's a bit where he's playing Jerusalem, I think. And all the audience are kind of baying for his blood or whatever. Oh, the film in backstage, he said, the vibe's not, I don't know, I'll have a shave. He has a shave and then goes, oh, but there were still moaners, even though we went back on and did it. So, well, it's disgraceful. I said, it's like, no, he didn't feel the vibe and he had a shave. And I've remembered that. If you don't feel the vibes, I'd just do something that might change it. But don't stand there singing Suzanne if you need a shave. I had one this morning, by the way.
What should we play? What Leonard song should we play?
Well, Famous Blue Raincoat's too famous now. Stranger song.
It's true that all the men you knew were dealers who said they were through with dealing every time you gave them shelter. I know that kind of man. It's hard to hold the hand of anyone who's reaching for the sky just to surrender. Who is reaching for the sky just to surrender. And then sweeping up the jokers that he left behind, you find he did not leave you very much, not even laughter. Like any dealer, he was watching for the card that is so high and wild, he'll never need to deal another. He was just some Joseph looking for a manger. He was just some Joseph looking for a manger. And then leaning on your windowsill, he'll say one day you caused his will to weaken with your love and warmth and shelter. And then taking from his wallet an old schedule of trains, he'll say, I told you when I came I was a stranger.
Let's do the Ocean Rain question, because there's that, what do they call it? It's like the imperial phase of a band, when it's like everything is just sounding right, the dynamic with the band is producing fantastic work, you know.
Yeah.
The producer's right, the arranger's right, the songs are right, and you hit that, didn't you? And and you've got that beautiful centrepiece of Ocean Rain within that kind of 3 album, you know. Did you know it was that good when you finished it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the line, the greatest album ever made, that was, I was on the phone from Paris. We did a month in Paris. And I'd blagged that, saying to the record company, the MD. And he said, what do you want to do in Paris? I said, you've been there, and you know how great it is. Imagine when you go there and you're doing this record and singing after you've just walked down the streets, all around the streets of Paris. It's going to have something else. Ended up doing all the vocals in Kirby, which, but I'd been to Paris for a month, and you know, I just wanted to go to Paris for a month. And also get him to not come, because we hadn't really recorded that much. There were rumours that he was, you know, going to just come and have a listen. It was like, there's not a lot to listen to at the minute. So I just said, he said, what's it sounding like? And I said, it's the greatest album ever made, even though it hadn't been made. You know, you blag, don't you? I wasn't worried about it having not a lot on, you know, we were just building the track, so. Because we'd done Peel sessions for a lot of the songs on lots of the albums, which was always brilliant, and we never demoed. I remember saying to him, that's how we kind of demo our songs with you. And he was made up. He said that's really what he wanted from the sessions.
Your relationship with Will, kind of only in bands, I think, when you get men that have these kind of, it's like planets that sort of orbit each other and fly off for a bit, and they'll always be next to each other, even when they're not.
Yeah.
And That must be brilliant to find someone like that.
Yeah,
I mean, frustrating. Knowing
yeah, because it's
you're bonded to each other.
Yeah, which is brilliant. But we don't. We never talk about it. It's
really.
We're always. Yeah, we're better just going, saying something funny, or we are sometimes total opposites, and there's times when we can't stand each other, but we're still here, and together we're the best combination that, for me, that I could have, and for him, I think the same. You know, it's from that first time when he asked me to come to his house. It was in a bar in Liverpool, and he hardly spoke to anyone, I hardly spoke. And he said to me, I've heard you're a great singer. And I thought, I haven't ever sung. But I must have, Pete Wiley was my mate in school, when I was a year older, and we always went to Eric's first night at Open together. But he spread the word saying he'd be a great singer. And then people hear it differently and think, he said, I've heard you're a great singer, you want to come to my house? I've got a homemade guitar and a drum machine. He said that in the opening sentences, and I said, all right, yeah, I'll tell you the address now. And I went. From that point to now, I don't think we've ever sat down and had a long conversation.
Really?
Yeah, never.
I quite like that.
I do as well.
I mean, talking about comebacks, Evergreen.
Yeah.
It's a good comeback.
It is. I mean, Nothing Lasts Forever was a brilliant comeback.
Yeah.
The album itself, just some really good stuff. I love Forgiven on that album.
I'm just one of many gave a love in vain. Sold it out.
It was about Nothing Lasts Forever.
And I want more than I can give. Just trying to forget. Nothing ever lasts forever. Nothing ever lasts forever. Nothing ever lasts forever. Nothing ever lasts forever.
You know, if that hadn't have got the play. I remember Joe Wiley made a Singer of the Week. I think she was the first one, and then Simon Mayo, and then there was a third DJ who made a Singer of the Week. And it was all daytime stuff. Had we not gone with that, because we were unsure whether to put that out as the second single, and then it was like, no, just easily the best set.
I want it now, I want it now. Don't tell me that my ship is coming in. Nothing comes to those who wait. Time's running out the door you're running in. So I want more than I can give. Just trying to
It, it felt a lot like what was going on at the time, the kind of resurgence of guitar music. It felt a bit like you'd come back and gone, yeah, we're kind of partially responsible for this, so we'll remind you this is how we do it.
I think that was unlucky. It was just, it could have been, with or without what was going on in Britain, I think that helped us and the singles, but it was more that song I'd had in its early form, just after I'd split the Bunnymen up. And that's another thing, it was a split, I wasn't going to leave my band, I split it up. But with that song, it kind of...
So you sat on it for that long?
Yeah, I didn't have it finished lyrically. I never thinking that we'd get back together, but I was saving it for something. And then I thought, this is it, it fits now. I can finish it and sing it as a Bunnyman, you know. Always, I'd much prefer that. I think so, though. You just can't pretend that you're the greatest thing on the planet. In a band, you can.
It's the gang, you know.
Yeah.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
Let's do Lou, then. Come on, this is obviously an important first. I mean, would it be Velvets? Would it be solo Lou? If there was going to be, you know...
The first Lou Reed thing I bought was in the January of 73, and it was a best of... It was basically the first album with a few other bits thrown in.
Sunday morning brings the dawn in. It's just a restless feeling by my side. Early dawning.
Sunday, you know, it was just, I got into them through Bowie. And I thought that name, the Velvet, that was unbelievably brilliant. Even now, it's like, that is the perfect band in a way. It's like, you know, they all look wacky, you know, and they were. And John Cale, brilliant, but Lou Reed wrote those songs, you know.
Didn't you meet him? Didn't you have a session with him?
I would have normally said he met me, but... But I've gone off saying that now, because I met Lou Reed. First time we were doing Pink Pop, I think, in Holland, and the bill was mad. I think I was the Bronski Beats, or one of them, Commodores were on early on. Then there was something else, then Iggy, then us, then Lou Reed. They were last night. I thought, where's Bowie? Then Lenny Cohen, I've got the dream day or night.
What was he like?
Lou Bronski.
Lou,
well, I just knocked on his door because I thought he was in his porter cabin type thing. I'd seen Iggy early on because I'd met Iggy a few times. He used to come see us in New York and stuff. But so I knocked on his trailer door, on his porter cabin door, and he answered. And he had a red neckerchief thing on and a denim jacket thing. And he was a lot smaller than I thought he'd be. I just want to say, I love you, or something like that. I think you're fantastic. And I didn't know what to say. I couldn't say, and he said, well, you sounded pretty good from here, or something like, but he didn't sound like John Wayne. and I just went, okay, you know, and then he got someone to come and find me, but after that saying, I wanted to go and watch him on stage, you know, outside the stage. So I said, yeah, brilliant. And I think the others in the band there, and I wanted to, it'd be just me watching it. And they're all there, and I thought, which I'm still like. It was like the thing with Bowie. I didn't want anyone else to like him, but I wanted him to be massive.
It's hard being a man living in a garbage pail. My landlady called me up. Ooh, she tried to hit me with a mop. I can't stand it anymore, mom. I can't stand it anymore, mom. Oh, I can't stand it anymore, mom. But if Candy would just come back, it'd be alright. Yeah, if Candy would just come back, it'd be alright. Come on, baby.
So, yeah, that was that. And then just when we were doing the Ocean Rain show in New York at the Radio City Music Hall, Rupert Christie, he was wheeling about for the, I think we had a 32-piece orchestra. He'd done the Berlin things with Lou Reed a few years earlier. So it seemed like that was a good thing. So, and he said, oh, Lou's going to come to the show. So I was made up, you know. And then the day before, we had a day off in New York before the show, and he said, can't make it. I don't know. But he's up for going out for something to eat tonight, you know. So I went, brilliant, fantastic. I can't remember ever being more fawning or sycophantic. Obsequious, in fact, that was the word. It was a Japanese restaurant, Lou Chosa. So we sit down, I'm supposed to sit next to Lou Reed, and I couldn't. because I just thought I'm already spontaneously combusting it at the thought of sitting next to one of my heroes, you know, and in a weird situation where we're having a meal, you know. And I said something like, I think you're the epicenter of rock and roll. Without you, no Elvis. Something like that.
That's a good line.
Yeah. And he said, no, you're too kind. And I went, okay, what about this one? And I said to him, my first daughter's named after him, Candy Lou. And he went, something like, oh, that's great. Well, not even that. And then he said, we're having black cod. House salads. He just ordered everything, you know, but I thought, I'm going to pay for this meal. I get to pay for the, in a way, thank. You know, I owed him a lot more than a Sunday meal. But the bill came, and I'd just been a cash point. I got $500. I thought, even in New York, that's going to cover it. So I've gone to the waiter's, give us the cheque or whatever, and I look at it, whoo, $1,000 and something. So I'm like, oh, God. And he's totting up what everyone's had.
He was,
no, he's like, who had the how many house salads? One, you know. And then I go to Rupert. Rupert, I need about another $600 something. That's without the tip. And so I think Rupert ended up paying a bit more than me for them. But he owed Lou Reed. He wielded the baton, didn't he? But I just thought, wow. I didn't know black cod was that expensive. And they were only house salads. But,
what's the track we should play?
I think I'll do Lou Reed solo. I mean, Walking the Wild Side's so iconic. But Andy Chester got the great BVs, Swoop Swoop.
If I could be anything in the world that flew, I would be a bat and come swooping after you. And if the last time you were here, things were a bit askew, well, you know what happens after dark. When rattlesnakes lose their skins and their hearts, and all the missionaries lose their bark, oh, all the trees are calling after you, and all the venom snipers after you. Are all the mountains bolder after you? If I could be any one of the things in this world that bite, instead of a dentured ocelot on a leash, I'd rather be a kite and be tied to the end of your string and flying in the air, babe, at night. Cause you know what they say about honey bears, when you shave off all their baby hair, you have a hairy-minded pink bear bear. And all the bells are rolling out for you, and stones are all flying after you.
So the latest album, The Stars, The Oceans and The Moon, when did you decide that that wouldn't just be revisiting old stuff, but in fact you'd be doing sort of different arrangements, different orchestral arrangements and string arrangements of classic Bunnymen stuff?
I just mentioned that I fancied doing it. I always had. More so that the voice I like best would be on it. You know, it's like pictures on my wall. The reason I wouldn't listen to it or I cringe is because the vocals on it. And a lot of those, even though at the time I'd say I'm the greatest thing on the planet, if I listen now I think, ooh, there's just so many, like swimming. I actually say ing on Seven Seas, swimming them so well. Never say ing, ever.
But the thing is, I like those little vocal inflections that certain singers have.
Me too, and I understand that, but it doesn't sound real enough to me. I've known these songs, lots of them, for between 30 and 40 years, and to playing live and stuff, and solo stuff especially, playing Seven Seas on my own on acoustic, ham-fisted acoustic. I can play well when I'm not singing or trying to perform. So I started slowing it down and just letting things hang, and I thought that's how I want Seven Seas to be now.
stab a sorry heart with your favorite finger, paint all the blue, stop your tears from stinging. Hear the caveman singing, good news to bring in. 7 seas swimming them so well, glad to see my face among them, kissing the tar-tar shell.
I mean, we still play it the old way live and on set, and we will probably forever, but I never thought of it as a sea shanty at all, because it doesn't sound like one, but to me now it does, with the accordion in, like a sailor who stopped sailing, you know, and I wanted to kind of get the lyrics across more, because a song like The Killer Moon, it's, that's a song which could be played with this pen and the melody line. And the lyrics are kind of, I think they're that good, especially on Killer Moon. The reason I said it was the greatest song ever written on hundreds of occasions is because I think it is. And when pressed on that, I've said, because it's more than a song, it's about everything, I think, that song. And there's a fairly well-known story about how I got the chorus out, but I sat bolt upright, woke up, and then the lyrics came. It came to me. It was like someone was nudging me, go downstairs, get your guitar, and write, remember that chorus. And that's what I did, because you don't dream fate up against your will. You don't even write that down in one fell swoop. You know, but it came. It was like, the whole chorus as it is, I knew how it should go. Neil Armstrong's got one, and I've got one. It's The Killer Moon. I'm now. That's where I live, and I sing from this moon that is mine.
And the final question after all these firsts: what are we going to end on? What's the final track?
Killer Moon. The new one.
Seems like a good place to end. It's good to speak to you, man. Thank you very much.
Love you. I've loved it. It's been great.
Under blue moon, I saw you. So soon, you'll take me up in your arms, too late to beg you. Oh, cancer, though I know it must be the killing time, unwillingly mine. Fate up against your will, through the thick and thin, he will wait until you give yourself to him. In scarlet nights I saw you, so cruelly you kiss me. Your lips a magic world, your sky all hung with jewels. The killing moon will come too soon. Fate up against your will, through the thick and thin, he will wait until you give yourself to him.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
But whatsoever I play, it's got to be funky.
Yeah.
One, two, three, make it funky.
Music. This program is a repeat.
It's the Six Music Jukebox.
The time.